Well, welcome to another episode of the Disciple Making Leader Podcast. I'm your host today, Ben Borgman. I've got some great friends in the podcast studio with me today. Got my right here close to me, Pastor Glenn Underhill. How you doing, man?
I'm great. Ben, it's good to be here. It's especially good to be out of the snow.
Yeah, we have been snowed in this week.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I am grateful to be out and about. That is for sure.
Yeah, me as well. Craig?
Hey.
We got Pastor Craig in the room with us too.
Hey, man. Good to be here. Brother yeah. Ben.
Thank you for making
Glenn,
time.
Ben and Glenn. There you go.
Ben and Glenn.
Two of the best.
Sounds like ice cream almost. Like Ben and Jerry's.
We ought to go into business together.
Yeah, much.
That's right. Yeah.
All right.
Absolutely.
Well, Craig, thanks for being on. Glenn, we're going to talk about something that, you know, I feel like as I looked at this, we're going to reference kind of a Lifeway research study. They put out regular studies just looking at different aspects of ministry and church life and pastor life and leader life. And this one is called The State of Discipleship. And as I read this, I just really, number one, it kind of it resonated because with a lot of the people we work with, I could see faces, I could mm-hmm. hear issues they're dealing with. I feel like it was very relevant, and the data was very accurate in what we're seeing as we're working with pastors and leaders. What I also saw was it's kind of out of whack. Like the heart of a pastor, and you guys can, I think you can say this or maybe agree to it as well. The heart of a pastor is to make disciples. You know, we don't meet many pastors when we're out and about training say, hey, you need to make disciples that disagree. And I think where it comes back to is, what does that actually look like? How do I make the changes? What activities? It's more about change management, or it's more about almost fear of saying, hey, we're going to do things slightly different. What's that going to cost me? What are my people, what are people's response to these changes going to be? And that's what, as I looked at this, is there are some complete disconnects in what a pastor is expressing from a heart level to what you're actually seeing in the activity in the life of a church. And so I just want to go through, we're going to break this up into three different episodes. And so as a viewer and listener, this first one, we're just going to highlight a few of the kind of the, as I put it, glaring stats that I felt like, man, that really is a point of where we need to discuss and really help pastors understand how to press through that, and really good talking points. And then the next two are really going to be diving into a couple of those stats and talking about solutions. How do we help pastors? How have you guys led in these areas to really have change and to really see effectiveness? And that's what really comes out to me, is most pastors are very unsure about what they're doing. Is it effective? Are their disciple making efforts effective? And so that's really what we want to just dive in and kind of look at this study. As a listener and a viewer, I want you to, if you want to go look at this study, we're going to have some of these stats for you up. If you're watching this on YouTube, you'll be able to see some of these, the graphics of the stats. But if you want to read this this study, I would encourage you to do so. It's at lifewayresearch.com, and it's called The State of Discipleship. And that way you can kind of go back and unpack these as well and view these for yourself. So let's just kind of get into this first one. And again, for the most part, my observations of this study really are that the actual discipleship activities don't match a pastor's opinion or their heart or what they really truly believe about making disciples. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. But so that, and then this idea of effectiveness. And this first stat really goes into the idea of effectiveness. It says half of pastors are satisfied with discipleship in their church, which, hey, that's a good thing. Hey, they're actually 50% say, hey, I'm satisfied. But most of them, only 30%, say that they have no way of knowing that it's actually happening. So you have this idea, okay, yeah, we're satisfied, but we really don't know if it's happening. Is it working? Is it effective? So why do you think that is, first of all? Why is there uncertainty with that? Glenn, why do you think that?
Ooh, I think sometimes uncertainty comes from a lack of clarity of what we're really trying to achieve. And I think that's exactly what the report very clearly states. And I think we also have some uncertainty wrapped around, really what does a disciple look like? What does it mean to really move someone from point A to point B? I think sometimes we tend to look at programs and say, hey, our programs are functioning day in and day out every Sunday, right?
Yeah.
And people are coming, people are attending, and kind of look at that and go, yeah, everything's great. But the kicker is are we really seeing true life change and transformation?
Yeah.
And I think most pastors would say, as they kind of look at the landscape, hey, people are showing up, but boy, we're still seeing a lot of things that look very similar to the culture around us, and I'm not terribly certain we're seeing true life change.
Yeah, and seeing that ball move down the court and people, mm-hmm. I can resonate with that. Craig?
Yep. Yeah, I agree with Glenn. I think that when you dig into the report, how they measure discipleship, we're going to get into this in just a minute, but it has to do with their preaching and their Sunday school classes and things like that, which are more programmatic structures. So I think when they're saying 52% are satisfied, they're probably saying, you know, I'm preaching every Sunday, I've got groups going.
Yeah.
However, of that 52%, only 8% strongly agreed that they are satisfied.
Yeah.
The rest of them are somewhat. And I think that's probably pretty indicative of, well, I think it's good.
Yeah.
You know, we got a good Sunday school material. We have, you know, I'm preaching every week, so I'm somewhat satisfied with that. I would think that's probably what they're talking about.
Yeah.
But when you press deeper into, okay, what does actually discipleship mean, which we're going to dig into later, I think then that number would probably drop.
Yeah.
Because there is that gnawing feeling that, okay, we're doing all the right things, but are we seeing the results? Like Glenn just said, are we really seeing the results of life change, life transformation? And this is a very frustrating thing for pastors because, you know, you're working at something that you never quite know, is this working or not? You know, at times it seems very subjective, right? Mm-hmm. This is why I like to mow my yard, because it looks bad and then I cut it and it looks good.
It's one of the most satisfying things I do
because it's very clear and obvious. And you know, when you're working with people, it's not quite that way. And so if I don't have a definition and if I don't know where I'm going with it and I'm just doing programs, then it's even more frustrating because I'm doing the things that I know to do, but I can't really tell if this is making a difference.
Yeah.
In their life. The only difference I can tell is that I have more people coming or less people coming.
Yeah.
You know, that's where the measurement becomes. How many are attending certain things, that becomes the measure of effectiveness,
yeah.
Right? Am I effective? Well, more people showed up. Our growth is 10% over last year in worship or whatever. And those are important numbers to look at. I know we can talk metrics, but it's not really measuring that person's internal transformation,
yeah.
Right? Another thing that was interesting to me in this report is it said 30% say the church have specific methods. 30% they said they have some specific method for discipleship, but really only 5% strongly agree, yes, we have a specific method. The rest of them was somewhat, and again, I think it probably rolls back to programming. It would be my guess is what they mean by that. You probably think that's it, Glenn?
Yeah, 100%. I think programming is how... again, do we have programming in place and are people attending mm-hmm. the programming? So therefore, we feel like we might have because again, I think we talk about discipleship,
mm-hmm.
which most often refers to spiritual growth,
right?
Which we'll kind of land into this in a little bit. But again, without a clear idea of where we're heading and where we're going, we're just doing a bunch of activities in hopes that it will get us to an end. And I think that's the biggest challenge at hand, because I think programs should always be how we move people into a structured relationship that then is not an end, but it's a means to an end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, another thing too that stood out to me, Glenn, as I was thinking about this, is the I wonder if the current models of how we function as a church mm-hmm. impacts this because, you know, 50 years ago or more, everything was centralized, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And so all your groups were on campus, your worship was on campus, everything was centralized. And now the movement has become more decentralized. And I wonder if in that, decentralization. I don't even know if they're meeting. I can't really see if they're meeting or not. I can't observe what's really going on in these groups. And so I mean, I know what happens on Sunday morning because I'm preaching and I see that, but there may be even some question as to how are these things even functioning. So I think that could even add more to the ambiguity of is this being effective? Is this happening the right way? You know, are we meeting regularly? You know, all these kind of challenges that come with decentralization. So that may be a contributing factor. I don't know. They didn't say that specifically in the report, but I think that might play a part.
Yeah. And again, you know, for you listeners and viewers, we have, you know, we talk a lot about Jesus. Our whole ministry philosophy and ministry goal is to empower you to make and multiply disciples like Jesus. And we really believe that because you guys experienced that in ministry. You were at this point where there wasn't clarity. There wasn't certainty. There were issues. Hey, if I kind of move towards this successful model that I see down the street, is that going to work or not? There was this uncertainty, and I know I can from experiencing being in a church for 18 years that is certain that Jesus is our model, and we're going to reflect that in the life of a local church. I can tell you that that's different than what I've experienced, and I can tell you that there is progress, there's effectiveness, there is life transformation. And you know, you guys, my encouragement to leaders out there is explore Jesus's model. If you've never heard us say that, if you've never done that, I think that's where the certainty begins. There's a perspective change. It's not wiping the slate clean and doing things all completely different. It's doing it with a different mindset. And that's the mindset of Jesus. And in that, I think we see certainty. We gain confidence because we're partnering with him in the work. It's not just because we're the most strategic church out there and the best communicators and all those things. You can do that and be effective and excellent, but at the same time, work the model that's proven.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And you know, not only does certainty or clarity come with it, but you know, kind of authority comes with that too.
Yeah.
You know, because you can say, you know, this is the clear model that Jesus had. This is how we're modeling against him. And you have some authority in that instead of, well, you know, I read a good book and this works in San Francisco, so maybe it'll work in Texas or Ohio or wherever you are. So I think you're exactly right. We're gonna dig into how to find that out. Because one thing, we'll just do what Jesus did. Well, okay, well,
what does that mean?
What does that mean? You know, just roam around and give talks. You know, what do you do? So we're gonna talk a little bit more specifically about that.
Yeah, so let's move on to another. Again, we're going to hit a few of these these observations from the study. The next one I want to look at, really, I think of this as it really creates this upside down idea of discipleship that we see in a lot of churches. That a lot of the activity that pastors are participating in the most, so like sermons and Sunday school classes, is actually not what they say is most effective in discipleship, but that's what they're doing the most. That's they're saying this is what we do most to make disciples, but we know it's not as effective. And to me, that's a big disconnect. And if you're looking at this, if you watch it, you can see the bar graph as you go down, it just decreases. But what is the smaller numbers on the graph, those are the things that are more relational, more intentional. And we see from the study, pastors expressed, 70% expressed that discipleship happens best in community or on one-on-one, but the activity that they're saying that they're doing to affect discipleship is not very intentional, relational, one-on-one. It's very large group, sermon-based. 89% sermons is their main way that they disciple others. And again, we would probably everybody in this room would say, hey, that's probably the least effective for pure life, an individual's life transformation, even though it's critical to preach the Word of God on a regular basis. Yeah. But I just see this, and again, I think the point for me is this doesn't match Jesus's activity. This doesn't match what we see him doing. Glenn, you kind of unpack, what would you see Jesus do?
Yeah, so when you say what you said is true. I think all of these things were things that Jesus was doing. Was he preaching to large crowds? Absolutely. Was Jesus spending time in more mid-size oriented type arrangements and having parties and dinner parties and things along the way and you know crusades here and there? Yeah, absolutely. But it is fascinating to me that where he spent the vast majority of his time, and I mean a vast majority of his time, was with a few.
Yeah.
And again, not in a classroom setting, but in an environment where there was instruction and teaching going on, but there was what I would call on the job learning. They were watching, and then he was having them do what he did. He was then observing what they did and giving them feedback. And I think he spent a whole lot of time with those few, developing them to lead a movement when he would go back to the Father. So I think when you look at the totality of it all, yes, we are doing a lot of the things that Jesus did, but I think we have flipped the script in that we're spending more time doing the things he spent less time doing, yeah, rather than more time doing what he exactly was, where he was spending and seeing the most amount of effectiveness happen in making and multiplying disciples.
Yeah, and like his priority. What did he prioritize? Yes, he did that act. Craig, you preach every week, right?
Every week.
Yep. Every week.
It comes every week.
Is that your highest priority? Yeah. Now, it takes a lot of time.
It does take a lot of time.
And it should. You should handle the word God with respect and care, and shouldn't just, okay, I wrote my sermon on a napkin and give it up there. But your priority of your life, I would say, is not the fact that you're giving a sermon on Sunday.
Right. Yeah, I think, I have a lot of compassion for pastors because I am one, and we're not like retired. We're like in the trenches every week. We're living this out too. Yeah. So it's not like we're removed from that. When you look at just strictly at Jesus' life, he spent more time with the few than the crowds 4-1.
Yeah.
And that's shocking. And when you look at though the demands of a pastor today, if you're a single pastor, you're paying the bills, you're making sure the church is clean, you're dealing with deacons and conflict with marriages, and you got all this stuff going on. In addition to many of these guys are preaching Sunday morning, Sunday night, midweek. I mean, they've got a lot of this going on. Hospital visits, they got to meet with their board or whatever the structure is. There's just a lot of demands on their time, and a lot of pastors feel like, I just don't have time to meet with people individually. Yeah. And I do sympathize with that. I'm not hard-hearted about that. But at the same time, we have to look at what are some things we can delegate and what are some things that I can't delegate. You can probably delegate some of these items. And then you have to say, okay, of the time that I have, how can I lean into more investing in people? And I've heard this over and over again. Well, I just don't have time to do that. And my point is that if you don't make time for that, you will pay the price for that on the backside. Not only will you pay the price for that, meaning your ministry is not going to be as effective. You're not going to be as satisfied. You're not going to see fruitfulness. That's what I mean by paying the price. But your church is not going to be as, they're going to pay the price too. Right? Because when you invest in a few, and then you release this power of multiplication that begins to move throughout the congregation. So I would just say pastors that are, they're very time bound on these items. Yeah. It's easy for us to throw rocks at that and go, well, you're not doing it. And that's not our heart. We're just trying to point out what this survey says. Is I would just encourage pastors, man, just, all right, let's take a serious look at where you spend your time. Let's do an inventory of where you're spending the most time. Mm-hmm. And then how can you delegate some things, and how can you create space so that you can invest in people spiritually and help them multiply, where that influence begins to multiply and ripple throughout your congregation, and then eventually beyond your congregation, right? But that's going to take some serious thought, and because if you just kind of take your hands off the wheel and let things drive, it will always drive back to these things, right? Because pastor, you got to preach and you got to do all these other things, and so that's one thing I took away from this was just, hey, let's take a good inventory of how you're spending your time.
And, as I observe your life, as we coach, and when we coach pastors and leaders across the country, as we're listening to them and as I'm observing them, there's some good way, some positive ways that I see this handled. Again, you're still going to preach, you're still going to counsel, you're still going to do that, but you don't let that drive out the things that are the most important, mm-hmm. that are going to lead to long-term fruitfulness. You're still investing in people. That's still a priority in your life. You don't let the busyness of ministry shove that out. And on a negative side, when pastors a lot of times initially come to us and say, hey, can you help me? They'll give maybe reasons like, I don't have time to invest in people because of these things. And I think that goes back to your point. How do you inventory your time where these things that, though necessary and essential, they don't overtake things that should be that also should be a priority in your life. Mm-hmm. You should be investing in people, and it can't just be through a sermon.
And by the way, Ben, another little thought here, and Glenn, I know you say this all the time. The guys we're discipling have jobs, right? They got to go to work and they have their obligations. And we're asking them on top of that to invest their life in a few. So yeah, there's a job part of your ministry that this is just work that has to be done. Yeah, right. But on top of that, you'd be modeling that, right, in such a way. So part of that time management, carving out space to invest in others is a good example to very busy businessmen and women who they've got a lot of demands too.
Yeah.
And yet they can still be fruitful in making disciples who multiply. So I just think that's important from a modeling standpoint as
yeah.
well.
Yeah, you know, I looked at this, and you know, you sent this to us some time ago, and we were just kind of all reflecting on it. And as I reflected on it, the thing that really is stands out to me the most is a lot of the activities I see listed on here are things that pastors are learning, whether it's through seminary or if they've been engaged in church activity for a long period of time. These are activities that they essentially all have watched, seen, and happen, and seen happen,
yeah.
and they've participated in it. Yeah. But very few of them, very few, and the one that is the last on the list, that invest in a few, and we know this to be true from our coaching and our consulting, and even in our own experience, they have never had someone model for them what it looks like to lean into their life and begin to invest in them so that they know how to walk with God, how to reach the world, and invest in a few. And so they agree with it, they want it, but they don't know how to do it, so they stay away from it. Because they don't know how to do it, and yeah. and so it just doesn't get done, because they don't have they've not experienced it. Yeah. I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Time and time again, we hear that. The other thing, and again, I lead ministry, the executive director here at Disciple First, but I still see myself as a church member in many ways, or just, you know, kind of as I observe. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to talk to church members right now. A lot of that activity is reflective on our poor expectations. Mm-hmm. The church in many times are expecting you to do these activities that really aren't in line with the priorities of Jesus. So a lot of it is, and I've heard pastors, I know what I need to do. I know that I like to. I just don't think my people would be receptive to this. I know it's biblical. I can see it in the life of Jesus, but I am fearful of how receptive my people will be. And shame on us as church members to expect things that are not helpful. It's just religious activity in many times, or things that we grew up doing, or tradition. And sometimes we need to move past that. That may have been impactful or work for you a long period of time, but what about a shifting, changing culture? What about a new generation? Maybe those same things don't work anymore.
Yeah.
But, and I'm not saying go out and find the newest thing, but a lot of these certainly don't match up with the life of Jesus. Let's go back to that.
Yeah. I think to your point, Ben, I'm just kind of hopping in on what you're saying. A lot of these things, preaching, you know, group classes, that kind of thing, this is a scoreboard of how you determine whether you were successful or not, right?
Yeah.
How good you preach, and then how many people come to hear you preach, and if your church is growing numerically, well, that was a scoreboard.
Yeah.
And so to Glenn's point, you know, we weren't, the scoreboard was never, are you multiplying and how many generations have you multiplied? That's not the scoreboard. The scoreboard is how many can you attract to your preaching, you know, moments. Yeah. And that comes from the congregation, true. Yeah. And that comes from, you know, pastors and how we, the model we have in America. You step outside the United States, that dramatically starts changing. When you guys go, you know, to Nepal, when you start going, now they still gather and have worship, but they see the power of multiplication.
Yeah.
You know, when we're in Cambodia, we're in places like this, certainly in China where you can't gather or, you know, you get hauled off to prison.
For sure.
You know, then that, this is kind of an Americanized issue, and we're going to have to rethink some things, but there is a natural hesitation, mm-hmm. especially for pastors of smaller churches that say, hey, my folks expect this. And if I don't provide this, then
I'm out of a job.
Yeah.
In a lot of cases.
I could be out of a job. Yeah.
So as we kind of close up, again, we're going to dig into a lot of these in a deeper, hey, what does this actually look like? And again, what we would caution everybody, and we always do, everything's going to be slower than you really want, and it should be. Change needs to be slow, especially in this unwinding cultural expectations and, you know, all these things. That's going to take some time. So let's be realistic with it, and we want to address those things. But before we close, I want to look at one more thing. It's basically some roadblocks that this study identified and that really that are keeping that pastors are saying they're seeing from their congregations. So this is the hesitancy that they're feeling. So you as a pastor, I think I can see examples of these with people we're coaching all over the place, but let's talk through those real quick before we wrap up about just what are these roadblocks and maybe how we would address those kind of head on, and have you actually experienced them? So as you're looking at this, the top two are people are not making it a priority. So their congregation is not making a priority in their life, and they're kind of complacent about discipleship.
Mm-hmm.
So have you experienced that in ministry? Can you relate to that?
Oh,
in your personal,
yeah. I mean,
can you relate to that?
Yeah, absolutely. It's the truth. I think, you know, the appetite for righteousness sometimes seems to be at times waning. Right, what seems to be, you know, because they're already coming out of a busy job and then they have family demands and then they've got to get their kids to certain activities. It just, you know, it just starts to pile up, right? So 100% I could say those first two.
Yeah.
I, as a pastor, as a leader, I could say, I have definitely bumped up against that.
Yeah, because, I mean, that's 72%, 63%. If you look down the fourth one, 39% say not enough people are interested. So this idea of—
I bundled all those together. Yeah. One, two, and four all seem to be saying the same thing.
So what do you do in the face? What have y'all done with success, or how would you approach that?
So can I just say this? I think Jesus faced this as well.
Oh,
it's not anything different, right? I think these are all the same. I mean, you know, even Solomon talks, there's nothing new under the sun. And I look at this and I go, this creates opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because it's an opportunity for people to come into a life encountering relationship with Jesus and it to change how they reorder their priorities. You know, I think it's what Jesus did with his handful of guys. As he spent some time with them relationally, he started to invest in them in such a way that he could call them out, call them up, so to speak, and to reorder the priorities of their life. And as they were experiencing that change, they were willing to start to make some of those necessary changes along the way. And I think they then started to see some dramatic things happen as a result of that. But I look at this as these roadblocks as opportunities that present a tension point for greatness to happen.
Yeah, I think you call them like coaching moments. Mm-hmm. Like anytime there's a conflict, anytime there's resistance, it's an opportunity to really shepherd and coach your people.
Right.
And I think that's what when we talk about a perspective change, mm-hmm. that's the difference. Not as, okay, this isn't being received, I need to stop and try mm-hmm. something else. No, this is an opportunity to coach. And I think there's a lot of wisdom in that.
Yeah, because when I've faced it with people who have said, well, hey, I just don't know if I have the time, or I'm just not really sure. It gives me a great moment to just speak into that and challenge them on it.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. You know, when I look at this, I think you're exactly right. I think this is an accurate reflection, but it is also a reflection of what our current church model is producing.
Yeah.
We're not producing greater, more committed, more on fire followers of Jesus. We have made our environments super low commitment, right? Just come when you can. We'll make sure the sermon doesn't isn't too convicting. We'll get you out on time. You know, we're creating this low commitment, but yet we expect high commitment from our people, and low commitment environments produce low commitment.
Yeah.
We're seeing this more and more and more. People are coming even to worship much less frequently than they were, 20 years ago. And so we got to do something different, because if you expect high commitment from everybody, wants, we want them to volunteer, we want them to give, we want them to do, be here and be available. Well, those are high commitment expectations. You're not going to get that from a low commitment environment. And so what is strange is you have to actually lean into high commitment environments to produce that yeah. in people. And that is this call of discipling someone, and that's a challenge. It is, and they're not going to naturally probably do it. But I would say a couple of things are helpful in our experience that Glenn and I have learned. One is that it's you're dependent on the Holy Spirit to do this work in this person's life. So just praying that God would convict them is a big part of it, honestly. And then secondly, I think a personal invitation, what Glenn was saying, is not an all call, whoever wants to be in a discipleship group, but you're coming. How did Jesus do it? He walked along the shore, follow me, I will make you fishers of men. This was a very personal, very direct call. And so I think this personal invitation, hey, I see something in you. God's got a bigger purpose. You're selling yourself short.
Yeah.
You're losing out.
Yeah.
You're missing out on the big, big opportunity of your life to know and follow Jesus, and for your life to really matter.
Yeah.
I find that especially men, that resonates. Because there's something inside of a guy, even when he's super busy and even very super successful, that thinks, is this it? I've pretty much tapped out my career, or I'm not going to tap out in my career. And so where am I now? And this call to a greater purpose resonates with men. I think it taps into something that God put in them, a desire to know him and follow him in that way. And then just, your personal investment is powerful.
Yeah.
And I think very few people have anybody really investing in them. You just think about it, not in the workspace, not in their personal life. And so to say, I see something in you, I want to personally spend some time with you. There's power in that.
Yeah.
But again, you can't broadcast that from the platform. But when you do that, I think you can break through some of these, resistance.
Yeah.
And then once they get a taste of that, the Spirit of God is going to start working on them, and their life's going to be changed. Ben, this was your story.
Yeah, for sure.
And then now all of a sudden, you're intrinsically motivated to want to do that. And when you look at a guy, you go, I've been right where you are. I know exactly where you are.
Yeah.
But let me tell you what God did in my life, and that's powerful.
And as I look at this and as we wrap up, I think the thing that really stands out to me, and you brought it up from my own personal experience, was when people invited me to more, I already trusted them. They had already been spending relational time with me. I've been getting to know them and so I think a lot of times when we're maybe asking too much too soon for these people. We're giving them false expectations a lot of times. I would say if you're feeling a lot of resistance, which most people are feeling resistance by the looks of this study, it's an opportunity to go deeper in relationship. You need to build more trust. And are you actually modeling this? Are you modeling the behavior as a leader that you're asking your people to do? Sometimes it's because maybe they've never really seen it. They don't know what you're asking them to do because they've never seen it. So live it out in front of them, build strong relationships, and then just like Jesus, calling them to gradual increased levels of commitment. And don't ask them to go too far too soon. And again, don't ask them from the pulpit. That's, I mean, again, because you're just going to frustrate yourself.
Yeah,
if it's always, hey, come join this. It can be the greatest thing in the world, but that personal invitation is what's really going to move people.
Yeah, I'll never forget. I know we got to get off here, but let me just, it just came to my mind. I remember being I was visiting a church, and a pastor was trying to get his people to invite someone to church for an event. Right.
Yep.
And so he said, I want you to raise your hand if you're going to commit to inviting someone to church for this X event. So he said, raise your hand. Well, there were very few people that raised their hand because, I mean, that again, they didn't have a culture of investing. This was not a personal thing. This was just a broadcast. Well, he gets so mad that he just walked off the platform, like walked out of the room.
Oh, wow.
And it was the most awkward thing in the world. And everybody sitting around looking at each other. And then after about 2 minutes, which felt like 2 hours, he comes back in and just pretends like it never happened and just kind of goes on. And I just thought, you know, I could sense his frustration.
Yeah.
His heart was right.
Yeah.
But his the way he went about this, you know, this should have been a one-on-one investing in people, challenging them at that level, helping them get practice in doing these kind of things, celebrating the wins together and building that throughout the congregation, not a broadcast. And I think that was just a parable, if you will, of just kind of how we try to do spiritual formation in general.
For sure.
We can't do it just from the platform. It has to be an individual. And if you don't, then you're going to be frustrated as a pastor and the church is going to be frustrated too.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Again, Glenn, Craig, thank you so much for spending time with us on the call today. I value your wisdom. I value your investment in my life and the fact that you do with all the same things you got to juggle and manage that you keep it a priority of investing your life in a few. And that is seen, I believe, through the ministry. I believe that I definitely see it in my life and other people around. So I thank you for doing that.
You're welcome.
For you as viewers and listeners, you don't have to do this alone. We are here to help. We don't have all the answers, but hey, we're swinging at the same thing you're swinging at. We're in, you know, handling church ministry and ministries throughout, you know, inside the local church, and we want to help you. So if you would like coaching or just somebody to talk to or vent to, we're here and available for you. You can reach out at disciplefirst.com, especially on coaching. We offer a free coaching evaluation on our coaching page. So check that out. We'll also have other resources. We'll have a link to this Lifeway research, the state of discipleship in the show notes, and other ways you can connect with us there. Until next time, thanks for listening.